hurry it.
I don't eat no meat, no dairy.
Hurry it.
The sun, happy planet, with all the carnivores and the destructors on it.
No member of the animal kingdom nurses past maturity.
What about this overcrowded land? How much more will you from man? Can't you stand?
Soy milk. These cows are for calves.
It's not succulent, tasty or kind. It's death for no reason.
Hello, and after nearly 5 years, welcome back to The Species Barrier for episode 2.1 of this new run. I'm flying solo in more ways than one now, and will attempt to put out a more informal type of discussion with people of interest to me. I'll skip lengthy news updates, as we all understand that we're doomed, right? Episodes will go up on archive.org, Podbean, Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, etc. As with the Facebook page and Twitter accounts, searching for The Species Barrier should be enough to find them. First up is Chris Packham, and towards the end of the episode, I check in with activists from Extinction Rebellion who hosted a local event. Okay, on with the interview. Chris Packham is a well-known UK TV naturalist and conservationist. He presented The Really Wild Show and is now best known for the BBC series of Watchers, be it spring, autumn or winter. He attracts negative attention from the hunting fraternity and speaks out about the bullying and threats he receives. I recently read his autobiography, Fingers in the Sparkle Jar, which was an interesting perspective of an autistic child not really fitting in with those around him. His parents allowed him to collect various wild animals, and there seemed to be a really high death toll. Did he single-handedly trigger the sixth great extinction? He also advocates for veganism and overpopulation advocacy, so he's a good fit for The Species Barrier. Apologies for the brevity of this interview with Chris. Some apparently got lost, and hopefully he can return at some stage to go more in-depth on various relevant issues. First of all, I wanted to know what brought him to his role at the University of Lincoln as a visiting professor in life sciences.
I like learning. It's the best bit of my job. I get to meet people most days who know more about the subject that I'm interested in than I do, because they're invariably specialists. And I like specialists. I like people who have striven to understand details about things. And so I get sort of parachuted into a position where I can ask them questions, and their job for that day at least is to give me the answers. So I enjoy a lifelong lecture about principally natural history, sometimes other things if I can twist it that way. So that's the best bit of my job. I liked learning when I was a kid. I liked the acquisition of knowledge. I felt that it, you know, would eventually give me some sort of context on the world, whether it was the natural world or anything else. So I've always sort of had a keen interest in making sure that other people can access that as well. And the university system has changed radically since I was at university. I went to Southampton University in the very early 1980s. And it's enjoyed a real renaissance, and it's really refreshing to come to places like Lincoln, where there's an enormous amount of work being done. The university is expanding, the quality of the teaching and the facilities is rapidly expanding and improving. So it's just an invigorating environment to be in, really. And of course, I've been invited to contribute in some small way myself, and I like the idea of putting back. I very much. Well, I wouldn't be talking to you if it weren't for, you know, three principal mentors that I had, all of which came from the education sector when I was a kid. And so without their assistance, I wouldn't be here today. I had a very different sort of education than most of the people who come to Lincoln University. But nevertheless, it was valued. And so, yeah, that's it, really. It's an invigorating atmosphere. It's great to see places of learning enjoying so much investment and such radical positive change. And if I can play a small role in that by, you know, enthusing other people to follow their interest, then that's good.
Chris has also presented a Horizon documentary on overpopulation. Given the studies showing how no environmental choice compares to the long-term effects of adding humans, I wanted Chris to discuss the importance of his patronship of population matters.
I think the world faces all sorts of problems. If we just, you know, let's just concentrate on the environmental problems. The principle, I think, you know, if you were to take a snapshot, a subjective snapshot of how they're presented to us at the moment, there would be no doubt that climate change is top of the agenda. That's the thing that we fear most impacting on the way that we, our species, lives on the planet. Of course, it will have repercussions for every other species too. It's in the news today and yesterday. Yesterday we learned that the CO2 levels had reached an all-time high. It's in the news today because there's yet another conference coming up where the Americans we're going to try and cajole them from not breaking away from the Paris Accord on climate change. However, I think that we are an immensely adaptable species, highly intelligent, and that we will cope with climate change. It will radically change the way that we live on the planet. It will be nothing like it is at the moment, and some of it will impact upon us quite negatively, but nevertheless we'll get through it. There's no doubt about that. What we can't get through is the exhausting of all of the world's resources, the things that we're dependent upon. And that's what we face in terms of human population growth. We're looking at an end as opposed to a change. So I think that human population growth is something that we definitely need to be thinking about and talking about. Unfortunately, for many people, it's an environmental elephant in the room. It's a topic which people feel uncomfortable to raise. And so that's why I was keen to join with David Attenborough, who's also a patron, a couple of others. Population matters. We don't profess to have any of the answers. We have an understanding of the problem, and what we are keen to do is to use our position to provide a platform for discussion and debate. I mean, ultimately, we're never going to change anything unless we first talk about it and then understand it and then come up with, through scientific endeavour, a means of addressing the problem. What worries me is that we understand the problem of climate change and we pretty much understand how we should be addressing it. We don't yet broadly understand the problems of human population growth, and we certainly have no methods in place that are effectively stopping that growth. So you're going back to the sort of simpler side of your question, I suppose you're asking me, is it ethically responsible for environmental student, science students or past and present, to be thinking about having kids? I don't have any. I have a stepdaughter. It wasn't the only reason that I chose not to have children, but it was certainly involved in one of them. And I think the other was basically, you know, you're making a big decision not about your life, but about someone else's, and they're going to live longer, we hope, than you. I worry now about the future for my stepdaughter, who's 22. What sort of world she is going to inherit by the time she's 56. It's not going to be the same as it is now. It's going to be radically different. And at this point in time, I can't see it being radically positively different. So I think that, you know, it is something that we should consider. And given that we live in a part of the world where we're consuming more of the resources than in many other parts of the world, our decision, you could argue, is of greater importance than someone in Somalia. And so I choose Somalia because they, per capita, use less of the world's resources than any other country. So it's an incredibly important issue. We've got to discuss it. And if we, environmental scientists, can't discuss it, then we're certainly doomed. And what David and I hope to do is to broaden that argument out, you know, broaden the debate outside of the environmental science field, as it were.
And to those ends, you asked your students to communicate population, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. There's a very poignant book called 10 Billion, written by an academic called Stephen Emmett. And he looks very pragmatically at the data that we have at this point in time, the modelling that's been done at this point in time. That's the best data we've got. It's not necessarily what's going to unfold, but it's what we've got at the moment, or at least when the book was published a couple of years ago. It may have been updated in some capacity. And his outlook is certainly bleak, because we know that obviously if there are more people, then there's more consumption, and therefore we drive climate change and other problems. And so it gets into a very vicious circle. And it seems to me that at this point in time, the most immediate route to dealing with breaking that circle is beginning to address human population growth. Of course we must attend to climate change. It would help tomorrow if everyone signed up and started reducing the amount of CO2, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's not just about cars and planes, it's about agriculture and everything as well. But we have the answers. I could sit here for an hour and I could tell you about, you know, not as an expert, but as someone who's, you know, reads the New Scientist sort of level on climate change, frequently discusses it, I could come up with a cogent series of solutions that would be a positive impact. I couldn't do the same when it comes to human population growth. And I feel that someone in my position, your position, environmental scientist's position, we should be in a, you know, a place where we can do that now. We've got a real problem. We've got to start thinking about this.
Martin Hughes-Gaines, your colleague in The Watchers, has been critical of nature documentaries that seek to omit the sprawling, growing presence of humanity and instead present a vision of untouched, pristine purity. Should the concrete and clay and general decay of urban sprawl, motorways, agricultural encroachments, etc., be represented more often, even if the final results are less pleasing to viewers?
Yes, it's a simple answer to that question, and it's very poignant that you asked this after, you know, Blue Planet 2 transmitting on Sunday night. I don't normally watch wildlife on TV. I don't watch much TV, to be honest with you, apart from the Vietnam War on BBC 4. But I did watch that programme. I happened to just be somewhere, and they put it on. So I thought, well, if I'm here, I might as well watch it. It was stunning, visually stunning. There was absolutely no doubt. There was a shot at the beginning of the programme of a wave breaking with the sun behind it. It just took my breath away. And they had dolphins in surfing these enormous storm waves. There was an extraordinary little cameo of a fish that was tool using a tool. Fish using tools, amazing. I came away from the programme having been thrilled visually by the spectacle. And it was on for an hour. And it featured the world's ocean, and there wasn't a single piece of plastic visible in the entire program. And there was also a very serious, I think, mistake was made when they were talking about climate change, actually, and the plight of some walrus that were struggling to find ice to get their youngster on as part of a narrative they were spinning. There was a proviso in the script, and David said something along the lines, I can only imagine, he must have been at gunpoint. It said, you know, that it was likely or possible that the climate change was human-induced. And at that point, I think I hit the roof and then the wall and the window and the sofa and, you know, I was very, very angry. And I think that was wholly irresponsible. We know, and we shouldn't be pandering to the sceptics any longer. So that spoiled my hour. But visually, very strong. What I hope is, and I have been assured by colleagues, is that they will get to the plastic. And I think that the last two programmes in the series are very much about the human impact on the oceans. So they've chosen to separate it from the glamour and the beauty and treat it as a separate item. I kind of understand that. I think if you want to get people into an art gallery, and that's what those sorts of programmes are, then you need to provide them with sort of, you know, beauty. And for us, beauty in the natural world is a utopian vision of an untouched wilderness. And so if that's a means of generating their interest, getting them to engage, so long as you follow through with the message, then that's a worthy method. And I'm assured that the message will be followed through on this occasion. The criticism originated because in the past it certainly wasn't. And I think there were many series that were made which were nothing more than, you know, visual, you know, wildlife porn, basically, but had no substance when it came to the important issues of conservation and environment. But anyway, it's coming. I probably therefore will watch the last two programmes to see how well that job is satisfied. But I think that there's been another transition, and Martin's debate was part of that, and that is that the people who make those programmes, what we call the blue chip natural history programmes, are very much aware now of this outside criticism of their portrayal of the natural world. Yeah, I'd love to sort of, if I had the mechanics, if I had the technology, I'd love to sort of put a version out on YouTube where there was lots of plastic floating.
And trawler nets everywhere and ships.
It was really uncomfortable that none of the people who made the programme, certainly not David, and would have been responsible for that. That would have come from outside. All of the people that make those sorts of programs, you can only imagine they're really committed to the natural world, you know, and they've got, they're out there for hours and hours and hours and days in very difficult conditions making those programs. And they are, in the main, there are some filmmakers, but most of them are naturalist filmmakers or, you know, zoological filmmakers. So they have a firm commitment to that, and that wouldn't have come from...
More so from the kind of people who invite Nigel Lawson to give his views on climate change.
Nigel Lawson on the Today programme, I think again I hit the ceiling first on that occasion. It might have been the bedhead. I was lying in bed listening to that. I had a rare morning in, and yeah, it's very worrying that we're still giving any platform to these people. In fact, it's worse than worrying. I think it's dangerous that we're giving them a platform. It's not even as if we don't know what their motivation is. They're paid up lobbyists. They're taking the cash. So ultimately, to give them a platform when we know that, as well as the ethics of the situation, is deeply worrying.
I went along to an Extinction Rebellion event locally to meet people with similar concerns to Chris. The main talk was led by a visiting Extinction Rebellion Leeds volunteer called Imogen. She faced a loud protest in the church hall as a man angrily screamed about the tractors that XR are using for blocking roads and they're having diesel motors. Some other members calmly ushered him out of the side door without too much escalation. Local organiser Eddie then speaks to me briefly about the schedule of events. Get in touch with their social media if you like the sound of what they're doing. The Monday meetup he mentions unfortunately clashed with the philosophy salon talk by Nick Zangwill, the philosophy professor who brought in the clicks at the Eon website this year with his provocatively titled article, Why We Should Eat Meat. I went along to put some points to him and we'll expand on what went on in the next Species Barrier episode. For now, though, here are Imogen and Eddie. Hi, Imogen. Great talk you gave today. What are your aims and demands as part of Extinction Rebellion?
Well, firstly, thank you so much for coming. And at Extinction Rebellion, we have three demands. They are act now, be the change, and tell the truth. So tell the truth. We've made quite significant achievements in this demand. It's to get the government and local councils to declare a climate emergency and work with other institutions to really convey the seriousness of the climate emergency. Our second one is act now. So governments must act now to halt biodiversity loss and reduce carbon emissions to net zero by 2025. And finally, be the change. So we want a citizens' assembly to make decisions about the climate crisis. So randomly selected members of the public, just like jury duty, will have all the time and resources they need to make decisions on our behalf.
So specifically, what would you like the government to do?
Well, specifically now, in the run-up to April, which is when our April rebellion is happening, about ending the fossil fuel economy. So to stop fossil fuel subsidies and new licences. We're in a climate emergency and they've declared that, and yet they are continuing not only just to allow practices to happen, but continually creating more, which is just completely crazy to me on why anyone would do that.
What's the state of play as regards your demands? Are they moving in the direction you would like?
I think it's always kind of swings and roundabouts, and it is important to celebrate the positive stuff that happens. We can get very bogged down on like all the things that are wrong. And there are coal factories and oil drilling sites that are being closed down, which is great, and switching to renewable energy. But there are still ones that are being approved all the time. I know as a Leeds XR right now are currently celebrating because we've had a campaign going for years now about Leeds Bradford Airport expansion, saying it is crazy to almost double its size when we're in a climate emergency. And recently we've just won that case, as in they're no longer doing it, which is amazing. Swings and roundabouts, but I'm at the moment really trying to focus that positive stuff is happening.
So when a government sets a future target, do you have faith that they're going to stick to it? And do you have faith that even that same government will be in power then and upholding the choice?
I have absolutely no faith that the government will keep to their promises. Again, giving an example about Leeds, they had a carbon budget for between then, I think they made it in 2020, to 2030. And it was all the carbon they were allowed to use before 2030. And with this new airport expansion that they approved, would have used up the entire carbon budget in one single decision, which shows that they weren't even trying to keep it. I really think they are greenwashing campaigns. Saying that, obviously, we do need politicians to make these promises. I'm not saying not to make the promises. I'm just saying to actually do them.
Do you believe that people making individual change is as important or important at all?
I think it is important. And I think we do need to look at our lives and see if we are conforming to society and a system that is killing us. But I think this crisis goes beyond the limits of what an individual can do right now. And we need a far-reaching aim.
So the title was Extinction Rebellion. which extinction are you fighting against? The sixth great extinction?
The sixth great extinction is in of lots of animal species, but also of humans as well. Their other talk, Heading for Extinction and What to Do About It, really does show the science in a very stark and harsh way, and the idea of human extinction or the sixth mass extinction is so fundamentally huge to think about. I don't even know how you really begin to absorb it fully.
You had an angry protester storm in on you while you were giving your talk today. You carried on very well and didn't get ruffled, so well done for that. Joe Public often has a lot of problems with this, and they move people out of their way and they want people off the road, etc. Where would you draw the line in your own protesting?
In terms of someone physically dragging me out of the street or something, I would definitely remove myself before physical harm came to me or anyone else in that action. I think everyone would. It's a safety thing, but it isn't going to stop me from doing these actions with the idea that somebody could. Obviously, that is a personal choice, but it's a scary thing we're doing. It's a massive thing we're doing, and it's very uncomfortable, and people don't always want to engage with that, and that doesn't make it a reason not to do it.
You spoke of inclusivity today. Do you think Extinction Rebellion has done a good job of bringing in people across the political spectrum and from different newspaper readers, like you said?
So this is actually one of the reasons why we're having this talk now. So when Extinction Rebellion started, there was a lot of outreach for it as it was new, and there hasn't really been like a targeted outreach campaign for a while. Obviously, people hear about it, it's in the newspapers, and local groups will do their own local things, but not like a national-wide one. And so this talk, the Cup Step Up talk, and the whole 3.5 campaign is about bringing new people in, and it's primarily centred around a door-knocking campaign. So we knock on people's doors, and we use tactics of active listening. So really, it's not just people who come to you, it's we're going to them, and we're actually giving people an invitation to come, because people aren't going to be on the streets unless they're invited. And that's what we want to do. We just want to invite everyone to be part of it, because it is a beautiful movement.
I'll keep you shivering in the cold much longer. Is there anything else you'd like to say, and where can people find you and your work?
Yeah, well, I would just like to say, if you're thinking about getting involved at XR, or you're a little scared or unsure, then find out more information. It is scary to meet new people and to do things you've never done, but what I hear time and time again is people came for the cause and stayed for the community. It really is a very loving network of people and a very supportive place. So I really do just encourage everyone to see what they can do.
Hi, Eddie. You are behind an Extinction Rebellion event in Lincoln today. Why did you hold this event, and what publicity have you given it?
What we're trying to do is obviously wake people up to the climate crisis, and we're using different methods to try and do this. This is another, it's an experiment, really. It's saying we want to hold talks in local communities, and we want to see if we can, by either knocking on people's doors or putting leaflets through their door in a local area, we can say to them, we're going to have a meeting down the road rather than, you know, 5 miles away or 10 miles away or something. Come along. And that's what we've done today. So we did it in the Burton Road area. And as you saw when you were here today, we had a turnout which was pretty reasonable.
And what else is going on with the Lincolnshire Extinction Rebellion, and how can people get involved?
So on Monday evening, we're having a social event at the Happy Culture Cafe on St Martin's Square in Lincoln. So that's one thing people can come along to if they want to get involved. They can also get involved by going to our website, which is rebellionlincolnshire.org. Or they can email us, which is xrlincolnshire@gmail.com. So those are ways to get in touch with us. There's going to be a talk next Saturday, along the lines of the one that was done today, a little bit different, at the Involve Centre on Mint Lane. And that's going to be at midday on Saturday coming. That's the second. So, yeah, that's how people can get involved with us locally. We'll be doing local meetings, local actions over the period. Over April, we'll probably go quite quiet because there is a national rebellion going on in London, and quite a few of us will be going down to help swell numbers down there.